race and Christianity. Let's let that sit there for a second. Race and Christianity. It's both kind of big topics, but in the next 30 minutes maximum, I'm going to attempt to deal with them in some way, shape, or form that will be meaningful to us today. So, first, is anybody familiar with the term growing pains? You've heard of this, yes. Okay, so growing pains literally refers to the physical discomfort that happens when your bones are increasing in size. And this often happens to teenagers who are going through growth spurts. So today, I'm going to deal with some ideas, with some questions, with some topics that may be very uncomfortable for you. And that is perfectly all right. Because growing pains are all right. They're indicators that as we are changing, as we are developing, we are reaching a different point in our understanding. And that is not always a comfortable process. In fact, it takes a lot of work. So I'm asking you to engage with me today in the work of thinking about the growing pains we will go through as we contend with our ideas of faith, our ideas of Christianity, our ideas of race. So, you may notice this picture. It's funny because, one, this picture was not posed, although it may look very much so. I was leaving from the Divinity School, where I'm currently a student, and as it so happens, a couple of my colleagues were coming down the stairs and we were heading to catch the shuttle bus to get downtown. And I thought to myself, you know what, as everyone is walking, it's such a beautiful day, it'd be great to just snap a picture. So I ran down the stairs ahead of them and, you know, waited for them to come down the stairs. And it just kind of came out in this nice sort of line, you know. You got this mixture of people, you've got, you know, mixes of gender, mixes of race, ethnicity, different kinds of clothing. You know, the young lady on this end is dressed up very, you know, sharp and, you know, sophisticated. Then you've got the guy in the hoodie. You've got somebody in a polo shirt. She's got on jeans. He's got on a button-up shirt. There's all this mixing, all this visual stuff happening, and you think to yourself, wow, that's such a beautiful picture of balance, of harmony, of unity. Well, real life is not always like that. This looks like a very nice admissions office sort of photo showing, hey, come here, because this is what happens here. Community happens. Diversity happens. That's what a lot of churches sound like. Hey, diversity happens here. You know, community happens here. Faith, questions, all that stuff here, now. So before I jump into this, though, I want to think about Matt's conversation with us last week. And so last week, Matt was talking about the importance, the slide doesn't want to change, there it goes. So thinking about culture as it relates to our faith, as it relates to our Christian walk. And the cultural experience of Christ is very important. We experience Jesus Christ in culture. We are embedded in culture. And he used the story of Jesus meeting the woman at the well, a Samaritan woman, a woman of a different cultural background from Jesus, but a woman who was in need, a woman Jesus was willing to step out and engage with, despite their difference, despite the social order that dictated they should not interact. And this for me, it brought up a lot of questions of identity. And I remember one of Matt's stories that he talked about in his talk last week, where he mentioned being over in Ghana and having a conversation with a group of people there, and one man asking a question about whether or not he had to choose between being African or following Jesus Christ. And I thought about the implications of that. What does it mean when this idea of following Jesus Christ is framed in a way that challenges your identity? What does it mean when we have constructed an idea, a picture of Jesus Christ that reflects our cultural experience and maybe not that of others? What does it mean when we are starting to mediate this experience of the gospel through the lens that we have lived with and grown comfortable with? There's a world full of people who are experiencing culture, who are experiencing life in different ways. And what I want us to do is to think about how that happens differently for all of us and what implications that has for the way we communicate about Jesus. So I'm going to revisit some of those questions of identity a little later. But let's start where we are. We're here in New Haven, Connecticut. And I live downtown, not very far, a stone's throw from this very space. And we're here in the United States of America. And this city, this state, this country has all have incredible history. Now, part of that history involves issues of race, religion, racism, and slavery. And there are other issues, to be sure, but these are the ones I'm thinking about in the context of this talk. And these issues are embedded in the cultural fabric of this country. So here's a few dates to think about, some moments in American history. 1619, at Jamestown, Virginia, approximately 20 captive Africans are sold into slavery in the British North American colonies. 1619, slave trade is happening in America. 1650, Connecticut legalizes slavery. So some people's conceptions of slavery is that it only happened in the South in America. It's not true. Happened a lot of places. The very state we're in right now legalized slavery in 1650. Let's go a little further. 1774, Connecticut prohibits the importation of slaves. Difference between importation and abolishment. They didn't get rid of slavery. They just said, okay, you can't bring any more in. But if you already got some in, that's fine. And somewhere in the middle of this 124-year span, a little school was founded down the road. Yale University, founded in 1701. And I found this to be terribly interesting because I thought to myself, wow, the school that is willing to give me a degree now might have considered me something less than human when it was founded. It's a powerful idea to consider. To think that for about 73 years of Yale's existence, slaves could still be brought into the state. It's kind of a mind-blowing idea. So you have this terrible institution of slavery overlapping with a revered institution of learning. And when we think about history, sometimes people think of history as just a straight line from past to present. But what we don't understand is there's a lot of things happening. There's overlap happening. There's questions of location. There are things happening simultaneously in time and in space in our history. And so at the same time that a school is founded, presumably for the purpose of educating, at that time, white men for Christian ministry, a very much unchristian activity is going on simultaneously. And it's not a secret. I mean, people know slavery is legal. I'm not saying every single person owned slaves. I'm not saying everyone agreed with it. I'm saying it was there and it was happening. And so we have to acknowledge this is a part of the history of this place. And guess what? All of these events happened over a span of 157 years before the United States even became a country. So if we think about the history of this country, to say that at least a century and a half of activity was taking place before the country was even officially established tells us we can't just cut ourselves off from that history and say, oh, that has nothing to do with us. We didn't start till 1776. Well, the Emancipation Proclamation wasn't for a little while after that. So there are some problematic factors in our history that we share that we have to confront. Now, just so you know, this history actually does have quite a bit to do with the message of Jesus Christ, believe it or not. A man by the name of Frederick Douglass. He was born a slave in the United States, but he escaped to freedom.
He became a famous writer, orator, and a champion of human rights and the abolishment of slavery. And in his personal story, the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, he speaks of his experiences with Christianity in the United States. And he distinguishes between what he calls the Christianity of Jesus and the Christianity of the land. And he offers these powerful words. He says, "I love the pure, peaceable, and impartial Christianity of Christ. I therefore hate the corrupt, slave-holding, women-whipping, cradle-plundering, partial, and hypocritical Christianity of this land. Indeed, I can see no reason but the most deceitful one for calling the religion of this land Christianity. I look upon it as the climax of all misnomers, the boldest of all frauds, and the grossest of all libels. We have men stealers for ministers, women whippers for missionaries, and cradle plunderers for church members. The man who wields the blood-clotted cowskin during the week fills the pulpit on Sunday and claims to be a minister of the meek and lowly Jesus. We have men sold to build churches and women sold to support the gospel and babes sold to purchase Bibles for the poor heathen. All for the glory of God and the good of souls." This is a real life insight into the historical face of Christianity in the United States. It is not to say everyone felt this way, but somebody as prominent as this felt strongly about what we call our faith. And it didn't just stop there. See, even into the 1960s, after laws had been passed ending slavery and people should have been free to live and work, there was still segregation. There were still activities in this country, in this nation, that were dividing people based upon difference. And these were differences people felt they could religiously qualify. They believed the gospel of Jesus Christ mandated and affirmed the right to treat other people as less than human. You can't just say that has nothing to do with my Christianity. I'm sorry, but it does. Now, some people might say, wait a minute, why can't we leave the past in the past? None of us were here at that time. I had nothing to do with that racism or slavery in this country, and that has nothing to do with the real message of Jesus Christ. Well, here's the deal. Unlike modern marriages, you cannot divorce yourself from your history. Think about how silly it would be if I pointed to an airplane and said, airplanes have no history. They just were here and flying. Wright brothers, who were they? I don't know. Doesn't matter. That's in the past. All that matters is airplanes are here now and they fly, and I don't need to know how it happened. That's just how it is. That would sound silly, right? Well, guess what? We have history too. And we can't pick and choose which pieces of our history we want to hold on to. It's all there. And it has preceded us and it contributes to who we are and what we do. And all of those pieces of history help to shape our present. So see, when people interact with you, they aren't just interacting in the present. They are interacting with their history. They're interacting with your history. I mean, there's a reason why history is important. My history of touching hot stoves lets me know I should not touch hot stoves. So when I approach a stove in the future, I know something about stoves. It's like, yeah, I've seen stoves before, and you may not be the same stove, but I have some ideas about stoves that I'm holding on to, and I'm going to be just as careful around this stove because it might treat me like the last one did. And so when we think about this notion of history, you have to remember history is not always pretty. Just ask the Apostle Paul. Paul, one of the greatest champions of the Christian faith, was once a great persecutor of followers of Jesus Christ. Here we have a man who actively persecuted people who claimed Jesus Christ as their Messiah, but later would write heartfelt letters of encouragement and correction and instruction to the same kinds of people. Now, there are those who say Paul did this because the Jesus movement was a political threat. There are others who say he had particular religious interests in mind. Others say he saw it as a rebellion to the Roman Empire. Whatever the case may be, he was not welcoming them with open arms. And you can call me crazy, but his future was intimately tied to his past. There was such a sharp break from the person he was and the person he became that you couldn't just put aside that history and say his present is all that mattered. No, his present was that much more remarkable because of the past he came from, because of the demonstration of the power of God in his life to change who he was and to see who he could be. And he couldn't turn a blind eye on things and act like they never happened. He could not dump his cultural cargo and move on without looking back. And when it came to preaching the gospel, he found it just as necessary to acknowledge the cultural context of the people he interacted with. And so we go to the scriptures. 1 Corinthians, the 9th chapter, verses 19 through 23. And he says, Paul writes here, though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all men so that by all possible means I might save some. I do all this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. Now, to thoroughly get a grip on what's going on in this passage, it helps to know some of the surrounding context. Paul is writing to the church in Corinth. So Corinth was and is a Greek city, and in Paul's time, it was a Roman colony. So right there, you already have two powerful cultural systems at work. Roman culture, Greek culture. Paul, a man coming from a Jewish background, ministering to people who are now followers of Jesus Christ. Corinth was a cosmopolitan city. A place where they were used to people of different cultures, different backgrounds. And part of the reason Paul is even writing this letter to the Corinthians is because he recognizes the difficulty of maintaining and building a Christian community in a place where there are so many differences in culture, so many differences in values, so many differences in meaning. And New Haven, though it's not a huge place, is very cosmopolitan in its way. I was out on the green earlier today playing in a drum circle, and I looked around and saw all the different people coming together as a part of this musical tapestry happening on the green. And I realized there's something powerful here. These people are united by something, some undercurrent of their human experience that on the surface you may not see. And Paul was appealing to the same thing. Now, you might be wondering, why in a sermon about race and Christianity, I have not said a lot about race? Well, to be honest, race as we understand it was not present in the same way it was in Paul's time. Now, to be sure, there was an understanding of cultural awareness of difference and status, but not race in the way we often talk about it. And I think it's helpful here to define what is meant by race. Now, if I ask people to name races, we might hear things like black, white, Asian, Latino, so on and so forth. But here's the interesting thing about those. Black and white happen to be colors. Asian and Latino happen to refer to location and ethnic origin. So when I talk about race already, this gets interesting because, well, how can black and Latino be analogous if one is a color and one is talking about location? How can white and Asian be both races if one is a color and one is a location? And suddenly you start to see even the definition of our terms is a problem. So what do we mean by race? So what we're seeing here is a couple of things happening. We're seeing questions of physical difference, questions of location, and questions of ethnic origin or background. So when I think of race, I'm thinking of these distinctions of difference in physical, geographical, and ethnic factors. So really, race and culture aren't totally distinct things. There's a lot of overlap here. There's a lot of meshing happening here. So we can at least think about what this notion of race might have meant, what this notion of difference might have meant to the people in Paul's time. So, something I hear a lot, especially in academic conversations, is how race is a social construct. People like to use this argument because they're like, well, it's just made up anyway, so why does it still matter? Why is it important? It's just an idea. And this is true. Race is not an innate or natural reality. It's something that developed over time as a means of labeling, of signifying difference. And some people say, well, if it's just a construct, why are we talking about it so much? Well, friendship is a construct. I am not innately or naturally friends with you. We were not born friends, but perhaps a connection happened over time. And friendship is the label that now helps me to define what our relationship is. And I place a certain meaning and value on that relationship that I have now labeled. So think about what happens. There's nothing inherently wrong with recognizing difference. I ran into Todd earlier today, and he said, hey, I noticed that all the buttons on your sweater are different colors. And I said, thank you, Todd. I'm glad you noticed that difference. And you know what? There was nothing wrong with noticing that difference. It's perfectly fine to see that. And you know what? I don't think people are racist if they notice that my skin color happens to be brown or that my hair happens to be curly. These are objective realities. This is a skin tone often referred to as brown. Brown is a color. I learned colors in kindergarten. It was great. I learned what straight and curly is. You know that, hey, my hair is curly. It's there, it's okay. No need to pretend like it's not there. And in fact, I really find it silly when people try their hardest not to notice difference. You ever tried to describe somebody without referencing their racial makeup? It's like, okay, so can you describe the person? Well, you know, he was tall and dusky skinned. I mean, oh, okay, so he was, what? What do you mean? Was it, oh, you know, just not fair skin, but you know, that other thing. I was like, oh, okay, so they had dark skin. Any range of colors, any tone? I mean, sometimes it's just helpful to describe things. Like, if I point to a crowd of people and it's like, or imagine you walked in here and you didn't know me. And you said, somebody was like, hey, can you go over there and get Kyle? and you said, okay, who's Kyle? It might just be easier to say, hey, the black guy over there in the gray sweater. That's fine. It's okay. Yes, I am what some may commonly refer to as black or African American or whatever may be the politically correct term of choice. I'm not really hung up on it. But it's okay for you to notice that. My friend of mine used to say that people who talk about being colorblind often just want to see the world in black and white only. But sometimes the world is just not that simple. Everything is not an either-or proposition. Sometimes things are a little more complex. And it's okay to acknowledge that complexity. The problem is not with the complexity of difference. The problem is with the meaning and values attached to what we call race. And in other words, people have used difference as a way of empowering themselves and disempowering others. Now, see, Paul was well aware of the meanings and values attached to difference. Paul isn't just throwing around this language for no reason. I'm pretty sure Paul knew the implications of talking about free versus slave, the implications of talking about people under the law and not under the law, the implications of talking about people who were Jewish, the implications of weak and strong. Paul knew what he was doing. Paul was using some powerful rhetoric here for the purpose of helping them to understand, look, my purpose here is to reach you with the gospel of Jesus Christ. This is the thing that undergirds our entire church. He's like, yeah, there are differences. I think if difference and culture did not matter to Paul, he would not have made it so explicit. Otherwise, what's the point of saying, hey, I'm going to become this to that person? I'm going to become this to that person. What was the point of articulating that you are going to approach different people differently if difference doesn't matter? One thing Paul is getting at through here, he says in the last verse, I do all this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. Paul had a powerful enough experience to acknowledge, hey, look, there is something to this gospel that has changed my life. So radically, so abruptly, so powerfully, that I want others to understand it too. But imagine what happens when Paul starts trying to preach the gospel to other people. You think there were people who had not heard the reputation of Paul? Think there were people who just didn't have any clue whatsoever that this is a guy who used to actively pursue people who followed Jesus Christ, who is now saying, hey, Jesus Christ is the way. It's such a powerful contradiction. Now you might start to see a little bit of what Frederick Douglass was talking about earlier. He talks about this contradiction between this Christianity of Jesus and this Christianity of the land. And people might start to wonder, you know what? This Jesus guy, I can get with that, but you, not so much. People start to wonder, what is your motivation? What are you getting at? Are you for real about this? And sometimes you have to be willing to go to where people are. And as Matt talked about last week, Jesus was willing to go where people were. Whether it was some guy hanging out in a tree because he didn't want to hang around the rest of the crowd, or a woman going to a well in the middle of the day, in the hottest time of the day when you would want to already have water because she didn't want people to see her, didn't want people to interact with her. Jesus went to where the people were, and Jesus put himself in their place. Jesus made the truth of God accessible to them. Why? Because the truth was that powerful. Because Jesus knew the truth will make you free. Frederick Douglass goes on to talk about in his narrative about the power of ignorance in maintaining slavery. The only way you can keep somebody bound and enslaved is to keep them ignorant. Think about the irony of preaching about this Jesus from a Bible that you will not even teach people to read. Think about the power of ignorance. Much of what we consider the problems of race are really problems of ignorance. Problems of not knowing. And ignorance in and of itself is not a crime, but when you are actively unwilling to engage what is other, when you have decided to keep everything else at arm's length but Jesus, you've got a problem here. Why? Because Jesus didn't keep people at arm's length. Jesus said, come. Jesus invited to the table those who had been pushed away. And you've got to understand, even in the very simple practical things, the things that we just consider a part of our lives, we don't realize how embedded in culture we already are. If you ever go swimming and you go underwater, you don't feel wet in the water. Why? Because it's everywhere. It surrounds you. It permeates your entire being such that when you are underneath the water, when you are surrounded by the water, all you know is just the atmosphere you're moving in. We don't often realize how we're embedded in certain thoughts and ideologies already. We don't realize how many decisions about other people we have already made before we even meet them. And we can say, oh, well, this is just the way I am. This is just, you know, this is me thinking independently. None of us got here independently. All of us is tied to a history. I'm tied to the history of my mother's womb. She is tied to the history of her mother's womb, and so on and so forth. So I didn't will myself to be here, so I can't say that everything that's happened has been my intention, has been my conscious decision. There's nothing wrong with difference, but what do we attach to that difference? You know, I think about these differences, particularly as it relates to church. I was thinking about my home church back in Detroit, Michigan. And there are some things here that would not fly there. Now, to tell you a little bit about my home church, it's a predominantly African-American Pentecostal church, slightly different style of worship, you know, other cultural differences there. Yeah, they love Jesus, love God. That's great. Yes, but very different. And so, whereas here, you know, I might be able to pick up an acoustic guitar and, you know, sing lyrics about, you know, heaven meeting earth like a sloppy wet kiss. But if I were to do that at my home church, they look at me like, I don't know what you're talking about, but that's crazy. You need to go. Now, it's all about context, right? It's not to say that anything's inherently wrong with that song, but contextually, it doesn't fit into that culture and that cultural experience of Jesus Christ, that conceptual understanding of God. It's not to say one is better or worse, but they are different. And if you approach them as if it is just all a picture painted in one color with one broad brushstroke, you are going to miss where people are coming from. You're going to degrade what is important to people. In a world where people have been told that their natural difference is a qualification for their lack of humanity, to now tell someone, oh, that difference doesn't matter when their identity has always been wedded to difference, is to do something profoundly destructive. So what's the point of this? What's the practical outcome of this? Clearly, we can't be Jesus. Jesus set a pretty high bar, and I imagine it's going to take the rest of my life to even think about approaching that. But what we can do in the meantime, where we are, is to be willing to step out into those uncomfortable spaces. To be willing to acknowledge that, yes, our experiences, our history with people who may be different from us physically, who may be different from us ethnically, culturally, that those things have shaped how we see the world. And there's no problem with acknowledging, yes, we see the world in specific ways, but there's a problem when we are not willing to change our prescription. When we are willing to dwell in the nearsightedness of distance. When we are willing to dwell in the myopic nature of making everyone else the other while we are the norm, then we are not willing to see the vision for the church and for the world that God saw. Paul knew when he was writing this letter that he had to reach people who were going to be influenced by any and everything. Everyone didn't grow up the way you did. Everyone's life was not exactly like yours, but what we do understand is that through the gospel, we are exposed to something that is transcendent, something that is bigger than and yet operates through our lives. So yes, there's something cultural in the way that I may speak. There's something cultural in the way I may present myself. But I'm not so fixed and attached and married to my culture that I'm not willing to be thoroughly engaged and attached to the message of Christ. So I ask us to consider today how we can recognize difference, recognize the meanings and values we attach to it, but most of all, recognize that there is one way in which we are not different, and that we all are in need of the saving love of Jesus Christ. And I pray we would not deny that to any other.